Let's do a review again, and then we'll pick up. The basic idea was that this experience is overwhelming. We've talked about that. And we've seen how it went from a depressive state to a dissolving state to the essential meaning of the experience being unavailable. Now, in the current parable that we're working on, we're seeing him try to control it. So that's the basic theme of the parable that we're working on, that we started last time. Whenever you have an emotionally intense... Oh, golly, let me see here. Record. There. Hello, Mary. How you doing? We miss you.
I miss you.
Mary's back.
The idea is that an emotionally overpowering experience can either lead to a reorientation or to a reinforcement of consciousness. And what we're working for, of course, in our inner work is that we reorient through these crises. He simply wasn't able to do that. One, the strength of the experience. Two, its distance from his own personal point of view. And thirdly, it was conveying information that was so far in advance of his time that it just was not assimilatable. So in order to right himself up, so to speak, he's going to try to put all the things that occur in this in this emotional experience into categories that he already knows of from Christianity. And that will have the advantage of stabilizing him, but the disadvantage of nullifying the intent of the experience to educate. Basically, what he'll do is he'll be trying to show, oh, this Sophia experience is really like the Holy Spirit. Experience the Holy Spirit. And as we said, there is a partial truth to that. The phenomenology of what has been described as belonging to the Holy Spirit is that it's a guiding experience. And so we can see a link. And the difference, however, is that the Sophia experience is bodily emotional. It's usually accompanied by emotions and desires that have in Christendom been labeled diabolical. Its intent is to bring value to this earth, not so much to the afterlife. Salvation is here. You could say, I think, if you wanted to take the broad view, that what the Sophia experience is trying to do is actually reorient and help Christianity evolve. That would be another way to look at it. So you can understand that any way you want. A very, it sounded like maybe even a dilettantish point we went into last time, but I think it's very important practically, is that the, as he describes the Holy Spirit, which she is saying now, you know, we can listen to what he's saying because what he's saying about the Holy Spirit isn't different than Sophia, but just Sophia's wider than that. But we can take some of his hints, is that the Holy Spirit is from the Father and the Son. We took that to mean Father is representative of law and the Son is representative of choice. We got into kind of philosophical discussion, which we don't have to repeat, but I still want to bring you back to the practical significance of the irony involved in these kinds, types of experiences. And that is, one, that they contain an objective truth. And as you, if you've done any work in graduate schools, objective truth is like a swear word today. There ain't no such thing, the modern point of view says. Jung, of course, holds a different point of view on that. There is such a thing as objective truth. The problem is that it is only subjectively known. Just because it can not be objectively known doesn't mean it doesn't exist. So that in these experiences, you are confronted with objective truth, which is requiring you to realize you're up against something bigger than you are that you have to try to understand and ultimately obey. Again, another swear word today, obey. But at the same time, that obedience has to be a choice. It doesn't count if you just obey everything you experience. It doesn't count if you simply think that choice is the highest accomplishment of the human species. What counts is that you can begin to discern when you are meeting representatives of this level of experience, and then choose to discriminate and choose to obey those parts of it which you deem as valuable. So both a sort of childhood dependence and an adult questioning belong to the nature of the ego that's able to receive this experience. And as I said, most of us have been raised either by authoritarian church figures or authoritarian parents, where obeying is something we've long worked to overcome, to not fall into a spell of the adapted child, so to speak, to use Pop's site, when faced with an authority, but to stand up to them and say, why? Why should I do that? Just because you say it doesn't mean it's right. I mean, how many people still are not able to do that? Authority says something and they cave in. Yet, just that alone leads to an ego that is divorced from the unconscious. What we're trying to do is both have a free ego and an ego that can connect back to the depths of experience. Sorry. Then he got off on qualities of the Holy Spirit, and that was nothing new. We went through that quickly, and we will continue to go through that quickly. That the Holy Spirit is a guide, that the Holy Spirit dissolves, the Holy Spirit provides a means of understanding, the Holy Spirit provides nourishment, and the Holy Spirit is an emotionally intense experience. And all of those, she's saying, that also fits Sophia. So what he's doing is trying to shove this experience into a church category. And she says, well, let's listen to what he's saying because we can learn from that. Also realizing it's bigger than that. And that's pretty much what we did last time. Questions? 2 points, I think. One, Carol asked me about the alchemical fire tree. And sure enough, I found references on the Ducat Works, and I wrote down what I found in the index, if you want to follow up on it. Volume 13 and volume 14. Basically, because of her picture, unfortunately, even if you go find those, Carol, you're going to go to a lot of work and not find much. But basically, all he says is that there is an alchemical fire tree in Simon Magus, which I think you probably already knew. He does give a reference in there to the original tractate, where that is quoted, not original, the church fathers, you know, who passed this stuff on to us were writing about the Gnostics criticizing them. But inadvertently, of course, they described all the things they were criticizing, so they were really our source. So he refers to I forget who it is, Apollotus or somebody who quotes Magus. And that may be all that exists in the world, I don't know. But that's what he's saying in there.
Thank you.
The other thing, was it in here or am I dreaming? Somebody asked me to talk about Gnosticism very briefly. What, was that you?
Mm-hmm.
Let me just do that real quickly. Carol asked, why did Jung draw on Gnosticism? What are its strengths? What are its weaknesses? you probably all remember Gnosticism is a version of Christianity that was in existence around the time of birth of Christ. It's probably got Jewish roots. There's a Jewish Gnosticism before there's a Christian Gnosticism. But we really get to know it through its Christian representatives. And the basic idea was that at creation, God got stuck in the world. And so the way the Gnostic had to live was to live in the way that the peace of God stuck in them goes back to God. As you were doing the dream analysis seminar, all the symbolism is reversed, where in traditional Christianity, the snake is the devil. In the Gnostic interpretation of the Garden of Eden, that's Christ. And Christ came down as the snake to wake up Adam and Eve so that they could realize there was a divine spark in them, so they would live right, and then when they lived right, a piece of them would go back to God. The real thing that Jung made out of this isn't that. Remember, Jung always takes religion as a metaphor. The use he put Gnosticism to was as a metaphor for the phenomenology of the self. If you take God as the self, as a metaphor, in the Gnostic view, then, life is a condition where God gets spread out into the world. And that's a metaphor for the self in us breaking up through our childhood experiences and getting lodged in projection in all the various emotionally important people in our life. So consciousness for Jung then is going to all those experiences in your life, all those important people in your life, positive or negative, and finding out what part of you have lodged in them. What of you have you projected into them? And then reassembling yourself through those projections. So the idea that Jung takes from Gnosticism is that we have to construct the self. He's got a bunch of different metaphors. I won't take up our time and confuse you with all his metaphors. But Gnosticism is just one of those metaphors. And what it does, it emphasizes the ego's responsibility and the withdrawal of projections, that you recover all of yourself, all of your God image that you have lost through the years of your experience. His other main metaphors are alchemy, the hero myth, an answer to Job. I think he had four basic metaphors for himself. Alchemy, you know, synthesis. Answer to Job is that you have to stand against the demonic aspect of the self. And the hero image is that you have to fight the dragon of inertia to even gain access to the self. And that's saying a lot in a nutshell, but if you're interested.
Now, once you said to me that the Gnostics were just as split as the Christians.
Yeah.
Now, what exactly...
Well, ironically, that sounds like a marvelously revolutionary standpoint. But they were all like ascetics. The way they thought you got the divine spark back to God was that you fasted and you were a vegetarian and you didn't have sex, and it turned out to be as ascetic as Christianity was. But the psychological implications of their cosmology are much different.
And was it, if I recall, it was Jung's standpoint that it was historically necessary for the church to repress Gnosticism,
yeah,
because the Gnostics were in danger of identifying with the self?
Right. The other thing about Gnosticism is they said you don't need a church, you know, because we are not dependent on God. God is dependent on us. That's the basic affront to organized religion that Gnosticism presents. And so no organization could tolerate a religion of individuals or people who stressed individual relationship to God. Now, why that's so important here in our book is you see why, because in the first 1,000 years, this sort of experience that Thomas is being assaulted by was so ready to destabilize the very fragile Western ego back into Roman barbarism that you had to have a kind of rigid containment in the church, which works in terms of groupthink, simply to keep humanity from burning itself up. So from the psychological point of view, one of Jung's positions is Christianity was necessary. You had to have a spiritual, organized, groupthink, psychologically powerful presence in the world to stop people from being Roman barbarians. And once the ego achieved that stability, then it has to deal with this stuff. That's why Gnosticism, Jung, Edinger, also I've heard him talk about this, felt it was necessary. It was a necessary repression, you might say. Of course, now we have just the opposite problem. We're so repressed that we're neurasthenic. Or we're in rebellion against the repression and just as brutal as the Romans were. Not quite, but getting there. Does that make any sense?
Jerry, am I right in thinking that the Gnostics also saw the split between spirit and matter, and that the matter that God was in wasn't the actual physical?
Yeah.
Unlike other traditions that see God in matter, the Gnostics didn't. It's just that God got trapped in this matter.
Right.
So there was still that duality.
There's still a duality, although symbolically you can see how they represent the compensatory view of Christianity that wanted to separate spirit and matter. They had spirit caught in matter, but still matter was a bad thing.
Mm-hmm. Something to be overcome.
Something to be overcome.
And they didn't necessarily see it in nature either, did they?
I think they did, which is why they had these prohibitions against killing. That's why they were vegetarians.
Okay. You said something last time about an addiction, spirit is missing.
Yes.
What is spirit?
Oh, we've got
it. Ta-da!
Okay. What page are we on?
No, we are on Sandy's bookmark.
We've got bookmark.
Thanks.
That factor which creates images in the inner field of vision and organizes them into a meaningful order.
See, we're always delighted to find somebody we can tell that. We've all heard it so many times that we're going crazy.
So an addiction, is it that you don't have those images?
No. I need to expand on that. That's Jung's definition of spirit. And I'll try to tie this in with the book.
Do you have any more of these?
Yeah, I do. Actually, let me get you one that's covered, so you not all like this. I'll bring you one.
She made those after a number of times.
We deserve this.
Yeah, it's in Number and Time. It's a quote from Number and Time. The idea is that the psyche is always generating your next step in terms of a symbolic image. And when you understand that image and you make what that image says your next step, in Jung's language, you're living from the spirit. What's even more important is to look at what you're not living from. You're not living from public opinion. You're not living from other people's perceptions of you. You're not living from a collectively sanctioned value system. And as you follow those steps, the other thing which is not in that rather, cryptic definition, is an amazing amount of enthusiasm is generated from within as you move. Because that spirit, that image-creating factor, is not separate from nature. Your own natural self gets invested in the you that's required to make that step. And so it's people who are living that way are inspired. You see, spirit is in that word inspired too. And it produces an energy and an enthusiasm and a willingness to explore and to get excited about things, because you know the thrill of discovering a new possibility in your life, which would never have been given to you had you followed a recipe. And if you watch people who are addicts, you will see this is what they never do. And if you try that in their presence, they will try to kill you. They hate it. That just seems to be the nature of an addiction. I think that's why AA emphasizes, turning yourself over to another higher power. Now, what we try to do is make that individual. What's that higher power doing? Namely, how is the spirit in you generating your life forward? And it produces, it produces somebody who is not willing to play the game by the established standards and does not buy normative definitions of success. That's the addict, you see, is always, they plan their life based on something external. And this is planning your life on something internal. Ultimately, of course, it's going to reach out to the world and you will establish a relationship to the external world, but through the internal. Really, with every alcoholic, I don't want to be rude, but I will tell you, with every alcoholic I've ever worked with who has not healed themselves, I've always said to myself, my God, if I had your personality, I'd drink too. There is just no enthusiasm, there's no excitement, there's no joy, because this is where real joy, real enthusiasm comes from. And it's not, the go Colts kind of enthusiasm, it's a quieter sort of enthusiasm that doesn't need great productions, but realizes I'm doing something of extreme value, and God damn it, it's nice for a change. This book, you see, Sophia is the spirit. Sophia is providing, or is trying to provide, that very sense. It's on that bookmark. The only difference is now that spirit is working through the body or through synchronicity. And it is astounding to watch. Without being indiscreet, I'll just give you a quick example. I was talking to a rather traditionally oriented person, and we're finally getting into the deeper meat of what is suffering in his life, and I said, now watch out, because we're not only going to interpret your dreams, we're also going to be interpreting freaky events that happen in reality. That was my way of getting across how the spirit works outside. He says, oh my God, I had one this week. You see, it started already. I said, what's that? He said, well, I got a video, and my wife and I watched it. My daughter was watching the exact same video at the exact same time in college, 2 hours away. We had no idea that was the case. How did two people in two different areas pick the exact, and it's an obscure video, obscure foreign oriental movie. See, that's the spirit working externally. So I said, what was the theme of the movie? And the theme of the movie was exactly what was in this guy's dreams. See, you feel the goosebumps? If you can have goosebumps, you see you're not an addict. Addicts can't have goosebumps over that. An addict would say, oh, well, it's nothing but chance. Or, but you can feel how the spirit, there's a life trying to move through experiences, first in dreams, then the outside. That it's just, it's bigger than you are, and it's trying to lead you somewhere. That's the spirit.
Another question. Marianne Woodman works a lot with addiction, but she also works with eating disorders. Mm. You consider eating disorders addictions. Mm-hmm. Okay, but I don't see them quite the same.
Not quite the same, no.
You know,
each one's got its own personality.
I was going to say, because with the addiction thing, I think you can still have that spirit. I don't know.
Well, with eating, you often have the spirit but no body.
So you want that spirit. She said in one of her books, you just want to quit eating. And she said she would just dance and dance and mm-hmm. dance and just hope her body would just disappear because she was, of course, getting less and less weight.
She was in her
She could just ascend mm-hmm. and just... I mean, she said one time that's the only thing that brought her back to earth. I think probably she could have passed away if she wanted, was her little dog. Mm-hmm. And she just felt like, well, I can't leave that little dog. So she came back to life.
Mm-hmm. That's why this material is so important. It's not just the spirit anymore. I mean, that the spirit is a problem for many people. But for some people, they are in touch with this. But what they're not in touch with is how this is talking to them through the body. That would be more of an eating disorder. The body itself is the vehicle that's communicating.
The spirit is talking through the body?
Mm-hmm. That's the whole point of this book. Mm-hmm. The body, I've tried to give you a little scheme of the body, sex, aggression, synchronicity, disease. That the body itself has become an image. Anything else? Okay, let's go to 296. Now, we're going to go very quickly.
That noise we hear?
Mm-hmm.
Is that something?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Okay.
It's the Holy Spirit. from now till the end of this chapter, certainly in major parts, we're going to go very, very quickly. When we get to the next chapter, we'll slow down. Let's see. Where were we? We were talking about qualities of the Holy Spirit, as described by Thomas. Remember, it cleanses, it dissolves, it nourishes. On 296 and 297, von Franzen just steps back from that a second and says, but the problem with Thomas's understanding of the Spirit is that it leads out the earth. Not just Thomas's understanding of the Spirit, but the Christendom's understanding of the Holy Spirit, which we might call medieval, was without.
So without body.
Without body.
So this idea on 297 of the Logos sort of illustrates what you're saying, that Sophia is the Spirit speaking through the body. Is that where the Logos?
Well, Logos and Spirit would be synonyms here.
That describes the painting very much, the Spirit speaking through the body.
Mm-hmm. You could say Sophia is the Spirit speaking through the body, or you could say Sophia is Logos speaking through the body. Same thing. And the other, I think, the other distinguishing feature of the Sophia symbolism, and it's not apart from the Holy Spirit, but in that Sophia business, you've got so much emphasized this a priori identity idea. what we've talked about, that there is a plan. Again, it's not apart from the Holy Spirit. It's just that Sophia emphasizes the plan aspect, that your life was here with you when you were born. That plan was in you. It's so important for Jung. I think Jung is about the only one I know of that works with this idea. There might be others, but I don't know of them. Now, that takes us over to 297. Now, I'll read the passage. Wherefore the aforesaid spirit, see that little quote, by reason of the excellence of his sevenfold gift, is said to have seven virtues in his operation on earth. And the point there is that you still see the dichotomy between the spirit and the earth. The spirit operates on earth, the spirit doesn't partake of earth. So, see, that's Trinitarian thinking. Does that make sense when I put it that way? That's when one thing thinks it's operating on another, that's power. That's control. That's distance. There's a subject and an object. That's Trinitarian. The opposite of that is relational, where you don't operate on anything, you operate with something. And that far the text hasn't gotten. She does want to acknowledge that the earth is present, but it's present in a Trinitarian sense.
About Trinitarian.
Trinitarian, we're back to number symbolism. Three is about power and control.
Okay.
These are very kind of lofty formulations, but it has a very specific practical meaning. When your body is saying something, do you try to push through whatever it is, your fatigue or your upset, your stomach ache, your headache, you push through that, or do you stop and say, what's it telling me? Very simple. I used to feel obliged when I was starting out working to not be tired and bored when I'm talking to people. Sometimes in the hours, I'm tired and I'm bored, and I say so. Not as an insult, but to say, hey, look, where's the energy? The energy isn't in this discussion. Where is it? That's the difference between trying to push through my body or using my body as a source of information and using that to help direct the work. So have I told you about my foot experience with my shoe? I tell you that?
No.
No. Did I tell you? Sandy, you've probably heard it. Have you heard it? No? An example, this is where I first got onto this bit, of the difference between working on nature, the spirit working on nature, or the spirit working with nature. I had a woman who, working with a woman, she's not from here, she's from another large Midwest city, and she would be talking, and this is when I first moved here, she'd be talking, and all of a sudden, my right foot would swell up. I couldn't keep my shoe on. I had to take off my shoe. It was a little embarrassing. And I'd say, sorry, I have to take off my shoe. I can't stand the feeling of my foot in my shoe, so I take it off. All right, and then I put it back on. This happened three or four times, and finally I said, what is going on? I do not, you're the only person in front of that I feel my foot is swelling. And I said, next time it swells, I'm going to stop our discussion. I'm going to ask you what you're thinking of. So sure enough, it happened again, and I stopped. I said, okay, what were you thinking? She said, I was thinking how inferior I am because I want to go to art school, and I'm afraid to do it. The story came out that as a young kid, she was like 40 at the time. As a young kid at 18, she was, I think, she was raised in Detroit. She went, is there an art institute in Detroit, probably? She went to the Detroit, whatever it is. And she's a very gifted artist, and her mother found out they were painting naked people. She made her stop. And so here was this very talented artist who never got to finish her training. And it would be a sort of a subterranean fantasy that that she wanted to go back to school, but she felt ashamed. And whenever she'd have that fantasy, my foot would swell up. So I said, well, you've got to go back to art school. So that much she could get. So she actually applied to art school. And then, of course, in art school, she would get attacked by feelings of inferiority that she was an older person. She was about 45, and the kids were 18 and 19 in art school. And when that feeling would attack her in our hours, my foot would swell up. I have to take off my shoes. So I say, you're feeling inferior again. We talk about that, try to get where it came from. She then, she, out of that, she began, I know what it was, her husband was a working class guy. They didn't have a lot of money. And she was afraid she was going to have to drop out for financial reasons. They had two kids they were getting ready to put through college. And she wanted to apply to a fellowship program at this art academy where she was. Every time she would start to do it and get afraid, and that would be happening in our hour, my foot would swell up. I'd take off my shoe. She applied to the art program. She got accepted to the school. She not only got accepted to the school, she and her husband got a free two-week trip to Florence based on that work being entered in another contest based on its quality. And then that led to a commission to the city for her to design part of the parks of that city. And with that money, they could help send their kids to school. All on my foot. If I had not let that foot redirect the conversation, then I don't think we would have ever known. Because she wasn't talking about it. See, that was so repressed in her, but my body picked it up. You could say the spirit in my body picked it up.
That's what I was going to ask. So that spirit.
That's the spirit working through the body. And a Trinitarian attitude would, for me, to feel, well, this is embarrassing to take my shoe off, you know, every other hour with this person. I'll just put on a nice persona and we'll pretend this isn't happening. Versus saying, I'm going to redirect my attention to my foot and make my foot the focus of the discussion. That is not working on matter. That's working with matter. And if you listen to the basic message of Christianity is you work on matter. And you don't see that matter itself has an intelligence.
In fact, yesterday, dust to dust we shall return, seeing it's nothing.
Yeah,
the whole
right,
mushroom
right,
thing is,
right, right, yeah.
The body's nothing, it's just
right. Dust to dust. And what this is doing, it's enlarging that concept of spirit and just saying the body takes part in it too. And your basic understanding of the spirit doesn't change, but how it works changes. And I think you'll find it does start saying different things. It is much less concerned about traditional moral values. It's concerned about whether you fulfill yourself or you don't fulfill yourself. And if you have to make some mistakes along the way, that's just fine. There is an ethic that comes through when the spirit is in matter, but it's a slightly different ethic. Remember the woman and the diamond in her vagina. That was okay that she was an adulteress as far as the unconscious is concerned.
Once.
Twice is infantility. Mm-hmm. Very important distinction. Well, yeah, I mean, the thing is, it sounds great, oh, go have a bunch of affairs, but it's not satisfying. She wasn't really happy. She was sort of excited by the thrill of the chase, but not really. So that's operation on the earth. And that idea continues over through page 300. So let's now look closely at one paragraph on page 300. We could briefly, the first full paragraph, 300, we could briefly interpret what has happened so far as follows: the initial inrush of the collective unconscious, personified at first in the sublime Adam image of wisdom, led to an inundation of consciousness. In this dark night of the soul, all the repressed shadow elements, the heathen Ethiopians and the sinful daughters of Zion appeared, so that the author fell into a profound depression. So your question last time, Carol. To save himself from complete dissolution, he now calls to his aid his conscious Christian views and implores the Holy Spirit to help him purify the black earth, the unconscious that caused the depression. Only one thing remains obscure and is stated in the text only directly. The black earth is wisdom itself. So she's pointing out how contradictory he's become. He thus, like Job, calls upon God for help against God. A secret enantiodromia, which is like a flip-flop. A secret flip-flop has taken place. What first broke through was the bright image of wisdom, but later this gradually changed into a darkness that is to be operated on and worked with.
So there's the thinking again, being operated on.
Yes, right. working with, you might even say, letting the experience operate on me. Mm-hmm. That's the difference.
So being with the darkness as opposed to trying to control.
Yeah. And what we don't know, but what one, if you can stick this out once, what you learn is the darkness will change on its own accord, if you don't freak out. And once you've tasted it once, then you are, in a sense, vaccinated against terror of darkness. But until you know, this thing will, you know, if I do my part, and there are certain things you have to do, pay attention, not be irresponsible, journal, watch it, suffer consciously, not blame, not act out. If you can contain the emotion of darkness, it will change. That's the stars in the night. That's what they would represent.
And it would change into a behavioral.
It will first change into it, probably an insight.
Insight.
And then that insight will change into a behavior.
But somewhere where they're going to be reacting or not reacting. It would change you personally.
It will change you. In other words, the darkness changes you. You don't change the darkness. The darkness changes you. And when it changes you, it goes away. Okay, so that, I think you've got the very basic idea. Do I operate on it, or does it operate on me? Or better, do I operate on it, or do we work together? Now we're really going to zoom. I'm just going to point out a word per quote, because what it is now, it's all about fire. We've talked about fire plenty of times, so we don't have to recap that. Page 300, fire. 1, 2, 3, 4 lines down on the quote. Page 301, the first quote, warm. Second quote, fire, first line near the end. All he's doing is saying these are qualities of the Holy Spirit. And she's saying, yeah, and qualities of Sophia. Page 302, burning. First line of the quote. Page 303, a slight shift. In the third place, he maketh soft. Well, we saw that before in the dissolving. The power of this emotional experience, if it's successful, is that it dissolves your hardness. Because you have to be able to receive the new and not defend against it with rigidity.
It dissolves what?
Rigidity, did I say, or
the hardness?
Hardness.
What did you say that was?
He maketh off, page 303, the first line of the quote.
Okay. He said, the emotional experience dissolves the hardness, so...
So you can receive the new... Second quote, receive the virtue of fire. More of the same. One little detail on 303, the line before the last quote. It's simply reminding us what we've said, that he's trying to take refuge in the light. Get away from this terrible chaos of emotion. So he taketh away all darkness and so on. Nothing new there. Page 304. Fire. Second line of the quote. And now, a slight shift. Let me read you the next quote on 304. And senior is actually the guy who wrote that. Senior is the Latin name for that Arabic guy who wrote the book, which is being passed around.
Oh.
And he maketh all that is black white, he being the spirit. And all that is white, red. For water, white, whiteness, and fire, and lightness. For he shineth through the tincturing soul. Now, here's the important phrase. Like a ruby in color. So the idea is that this process eventually produces color. And in alchemy, that's a well-known motif called the cauda povonis, which is on page 305, the first, second line of the first full paragraph, that second senior's remark that the soul produces the colors is an allusion to the motif of the cauda povonis. Cauda povonis means peacock's tail. If you can think of a peacock's tail and its iridescent colors, that image is not infrequent in dreams. It shows up basically mostly as, where do you think this shows up in dreams?
Peacock's tail?
Mm-hmm. This motif.
Actually, what do you mean where?
In what image? In what form? Oh. Actually, it's...
Rainbow?
Actually, I hadn't thought of that. Yeah, the rainbow and sunrise. The, you know, the gradation from red to blue, it's sunrise or a rainbow. Actually, a rainbow is, I hadn't thought of that, but that does occur. Yeah. And that occurs at the end of the process. When the fire is turning into warmth. Now, as we're going to see from probably about this point forward, all the imagery in this text looks like healing. Excuse me. Looks like healing. So we're going to study the imagery as a sort of testament to the kind of imagery that shows up in the healing phase of the chaotic experience. The problem that she's going to say is, however, he's not integrating the healing. So it's like we're starting to watch a movie. This stuff is going to come up in his unconscious, which normally one would help somebody try to integrate, but he doesn't have anybody to try to help him integrate it. So doesn't mean, though, that that image isn't going to teach us a lot, particularly in the next chapter. We will start to see how the psyche produces images that represent the healing of the chaos he's just been through. And we can study them as a valuable resource for knowing what to expect in dreams when this process is starting to not just tear you apart, but put you back together again. But he himself will not have achieved that, she feels. But sure enough, in the process, like the Sophia experience, when you've been, you know, driven to exasperation with the intense emotionality, it will begin to change, and it will begin to change around that time you begin having dreams of rainbows or sunrises, a multicolored stone. It really does show up in dreams, and that would indicate that what was once a hot fire is now becoming a nuanced display of emotional faculties. So that you don't just understand the thing intellectually. The spectrum of colors is the feeling gradations that go along with what you just understood mentally. And that's what we begin to see occurring here.
But he's still not integrated.
He will not integrate it.
Even though he's dreaming this or having these...
Yeah, there's nobody to help him integrate it. So whether it's integrated or not, the unconscious still produces those images. In fact, you could even say that's what a psychosis is. A psychosis is the whole replay of the healing process with nobody at home to receive it. That's what John Perry discovered in his work with, I don't know if you know his work with psychotics, self and psychotic process. He had a clinic in San Francisco. This was back in the 70s when they had money. And it was a clinic for first-time schizophrenics, mostly teenagers, late teens is when it generally hits. And they would throw them in there. We had one-on-one, one staff to one patient. Seemingly they just simply could not afford it now, but they could then. And they gave them no medication, and they healed in about a month or two. And what they went through was all these sorts of images. And his books are on how psychosis is really a healing process for some other problem. Psychosis isn't the problem. The psychosis is the healing. And the problem is usually very, very, very low self-esteem. That's how he phrased it. And then what they were trying to do is be with the person and bring them along with their experience. But here there's nobody to do that. But the unconscious keeps producing it anyway. And if it doesn't get it the first time around, it'll be back. But he died.
And you were talking to you at one point about James Joyce and his daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And that Jung had seen her, and there had to be some changes made, and Joyce refused
yeah.
to make them.
Yeah.
With her and with himself.
Right, right.
That was
so the process keeps repeating. That you look like you get healing, and then it starts all over again.
So is that like dreams and repeating
mm-hmm.
dreams, maybe in a different way?
Mm-hmm.
I'd read, I think in the dream analysis seminar, that it's talking about though, or somewhere, I read it recently, they were talking about as long as you acknowledge the dream or remember the dream, whether you do anything with it or not, you still have done a process part on it. Now, not as much as if you would have been working on it, but that it's still, because if you have consciously thought about it, it has made a step.
Maybe. I think generally you have to have understood it, and then it goes away.
And again, it's kind of getting that but working with it. Like, for me, a lot of it's the doing and not working on it.
You don't think just acknowledging or just actually seeing it, is seeing the thing a step.
I wouldn't say it's not a step.
Because when I read it, I don't know if it was in the Young book on dreams or the dream analysis thing, but they were saying, now, of course, it won't be as much as if you're working with it, kind of thing. But they were qualifying it as being better than nothing, kind of thing.
I always say it's like giving your dog a tenth of a bowl of food. You know, why don't you give it a whole bowl of food? Should we stop? Have a break?